Welcome to People Helping People, the podcast for social entrepreneurs who want to build a social impact business. I'm your host, Adam Morris, and today we're going to explore nonprofit innovation with Leah Kroll, author of the book Innovation for Social Change, How Wildly Successful Nonprofits Inspire and Deliver Results. Leah is also the Senior Director of Strategy and Innovation at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's worked with nonprofits for a couple of decades and has so much experience and insight into how successful nonprofits continue to innovate. So Leah, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited. Can we start off? Can you just tell us a bit about what the book is about?
Yeah, basically the book reflects, you know, my two decades or so of experience in the nonprofit sector. I have this very interesting role as sort of an internal consultant at a nonprofit where I'm helping our program teams think about what is it we're trying to do. I do a lot of whiteboard sessions where I'm trying to draw out their thinking on program strategy and metrics, how we measure success. And just through working on that and doing tons of workshops, one day my executive director knocked on my door and he said, "Hey, Leah, I've been hearing good things about these workshops of yours. Why don't you put it into book form? You can do it on our time." And that offer just kind of blew my mind. And of course, I said yes. In a way, it was sort of my secret heart's desire. I just thought, oh, someday, you know, when I'm closer to retirement, I set out to take like about 20 years worth of PowerPoints from workshops and try to convert them into book form. And then the pandemic happened. So I had kind of this quiet time to do interviews and research. And what I was really trying to do with the book was help busy nonprofit practitioners to think through how can we be a more effective or innovative organization, and just kind of look under the hood. And through gathering all these stories, not only was I looking at, you know, nonprofit powerhouses that we've heard of, success stories, and just trying to understand, you know, their origin stories and how did they do it, but very importantly, also trying to find stories of nonprofit failure as well and pull out those lessons so that we can learn from them and not repeat them.
I love that. Starting on the side where, you know, nonprofits often fail or don't succeed, what are some of the stumbling blocks that nonprofits face when it comes to innovation?
Oh, I love that question. Yeah, usually in most of my workshops or book talks, I'll start out pretty early on asking the audience, you know, if we think innovation is important or good, what gets in the way of that? And maybe even taking a step back, what do we even mean by innovation in a social change or nonprofit space? And so to me, innovation just means, you know, finding newer, better ways of doing things, just finding some way to add value. And it can be big, it can be small. So in the nonprofit world, an example of really big innovation of social change might be the civil rights movement, or the creation of the 911 emergency phone system was created. There's an interesting story with that, how it was created between partnerships between the philanthropy world and nonprofits. So those are big, but then you have small innovation that we want as well. And it could be something as simple as switching from a paper-based data intake system to, you know, maybe having iPads at your reception area. Now you've just saved time and steps and resources that can be put to better use elsewhere. So innovation can be big, it can be small. I think we all can agree that's good and we want to see that happen. But to your point, well, what gets in the way? So when I ask audiences that, I hear a lot of trends there. You know, folks listening in will probably say, oh, yes, I agree. You know, so like being spread too thin, burnout is a common problem. Saying no to things is hard because in the nonprofit world, we're very passionate about our mission or the people we're serving. And so it can be very hard to say no to things. So we end up getting burnout can be really common. I often see what I'll call the fog of good intentions. So we have some, you know, problem that we're passionate about solving, but we're not exactly sure of how we're going to solve it. So it can be foggy. I like that saying by Stephen Covey that, you know, we might be climbing up the ladder, but is our ladder leaning against the right wall in the first place? And how do we know? So yeah, lots of, you know, bureaucracy, right? Or having metrics imposed that don't make sense on us. I could go on and on, right? Yeah. But I'm sure you could add to the list, right, with your experience with nonprofits. So plenty of things get in the way. And that was a big part of the book is let's not hide, shove those under the rug. Let's be honest. Let's bring those out into the open and then figure out, so what can a nonprofit do, you know, as an organization with its organizational design and structure to really encourage innovation rather than squash it? And then what can we do as individuals? So the book is a lot about both of those.
Fantastic. So when a nonprofit comes to one of your workshops and let's say they've been struggling with burnout and maybe mission creep and having this kind of foggy objective of like, hey, we want to solve this problem, but we're not exactly sure how. where do they even begin in terms of like, how do I approach innovation?
Yeah, I like to begin here. And this is where the book begins too. About the first third of the book takes a practice called design thinking, which is something any nonprofit can do to help teams sort of get clarity on, you know, what is it that we're trying to do in the first place? So design thinking is a pretty helpful tool and it's not expensive. It's just a series of thought exercises. I think that's a great place to start.
Neat. And you have an approach for that kind of design for nonprofits. Like, what does that look like?
Yes, yes. So I'm a big believer in stealing good ideas wherever you see them. Where I first stumbled onto design thinking with Pixar. Most of us are familiar with Pixar. They've won 23 Academy Awards. They're a movie company. They've made some of the most highest grossing animated films of all time, like Toy Story. So what is the secret to their success? I'm a voracious reader and I just love anything from biographies to company success stories to nonprofit success stories. And that's how I stumbled across Pixar. So what I learned is at Pixar, this is a little bit surprising, but teams are expected to give what they call brutal feedback to each other. And a Pixar executive says that they assume early on that all of our movies suck. And the job of the creative feedback process is to get the movie from suck to unsuck. And that's shocking language to us. But the same executive explained that importantly, everyone in the room knows that the questions raised must be in the spirit of making the creative product as good as it possibly can be. Mm-hmm. So, of course, without the manager setting the tone as a safe space, that kind of tough love feedback would never get off the ground. So then how do they do this? So they use a creative process called design thinking, and it's been used for decades by lots of creative companies and marketing companies. But there are some parallels to designing a movie and designing nonprofit programs and interventions. And I'm a big believer that we can translate design thinking techniques for our own use in nonprofits. And the first third of my book breaks out how to do that. So if design thinking is a process for exploring what's possible and thinking creatively and strategically, what I'll share is kind of the Leah version. This is their mini versions, right? But I'm a strong believer that you can't just kind of lift up processes from the for-profit world and just plunk it on top of a nonprofit space. You have to mindfully translate it. And so that's what I've done. I tested out design thinking, kind of pulled what made sense in a nonprofit space. So this Leah version in my book of design thinking is asking ourselves first three questions. What's desirable, what's scalable, and what's feasible? And then those are kind of the thinking questions. And it's followed by a fourth question, which is the action part, which is then once we've done this thinking, then how do we design pilots and small experiments to test that thinking? And so my book in the first third of it breaks those out. There's a chapter on each, along with stories and examples that you can either take your team through, or you could just use it as kind of your own back of the envelope thinking as you're reading the book to get ideas.
I love that. And especially kind of what you said at the beginning about creating a safe space where you know what the objective is. So if you are doing something that is more critical or diving in deep, that it's about a larger intention. So it creates that environment where people are able to open up and not be overly critical or judgmental.
Yes, yes. And the middle part of the book is more, it shifts towards organizational design, which includes things like your workplace culture, the role of the supervisor, and even language you can use as a supervisor to kind of model that. To me, I was very inspired by Edward Deming, who's considered the father of quality systems. He's probably the person who's inspired my work and my thinking the most. But yeah, he's all about systems. And I think he has like, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 tenets of best practices in the workplace. And one of them is a culture of no fear. And I think that's so true. And you see it in Pixar. And yeah, I've had the privilege to work at a pretty entrepreneurially spirited nonprofit where we have that.
Got it. And it's a fairly large nonprofit that you're with, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I think where our staff is probably around 160, 170. To me, that's large. I mean, the nonprofits I've worked with, or consulted with have been pretty small. A lot of nonprofits are smaller. So yeah, I think we're a little bit larger than, maybe we're medium sized.
Yeah. That's like you still have to compete for projects and ideas of how you, pull things forward.
Yes, definitely. Towards the last section of my book is all about bringing your own personal innovation A game, and persuasion is a big one in there. And as we know in nonprofits, we have to get resources for our ideas. We have to compete for resources. So of course we have to persuade donors and make our best case, but like in an organization the size of my nonprofit, you have to persuade the people down the hall. We have a a media team, and they have many, many teams to support, and they have to choose how best to spend their time. So you have to persuade. Or if you want to find like superstar talent to work at your nonprofit, you have to persuade. So all those practices and design thinking are so helpful in getting clarity about your thinking of what is it we're trying to do, and that's going to help you with persuasion.
Do you have any examples of how that's played out in your company?
Let's see. So many good examples in the book. I think after I wrote the book, I counted up there were 70 stories of 70 nonprofits and I think an additional 20 foundations. So I was just really proud of that, you know, finding. And I've been told by readers that was so helpful from a diversity of different kinds of nonprofits, whether it's Grayston Bakery, Workforce Development Nonprofit, or Mayo Clinic, or Alcoholics Anonymous.
What did Mayo Clinic do in terms of bringing innovation into the organization?
Yes, Mayo Clinic is a really great example of innovation. They might be considered one of the best nonprofit hospitals in the world. They're famous for finding innovative solutions for people who are very sick. And their reputation did not happen by accident. In interviews, team members will say that good patient outcomes are because they are empowered to carry out their organizational values. And one of those values is the needs of the patient come first, and they seem to truly live this. So team members at Mayo Clinic are trained, empowered, and encouraged to put those values into practice. And I'll just quote from a Mayo staff member who said, "If the employee's choices are either getting back to work on time or taking 10 minutes to get a wheelchair for a patient who seems unsteady, the patient will get the wheelchair." And I think that's incredible. That's bottom-up empowerment. And, you know, those values become part of their workplace culture, guiding all decisions, big or small. In a similar story, the night staff at Mayo Clinic were concerned for how noise can affect a patient's sleep, which, as we know, is really important to the healing process. And so the night staff came up with the idea to conduct noise studies. And this then led to quieter flooring, quieter wheels on carts, and lower decibels for overhead paging. And to me, that's innovation and bottom-up empowerment. So that middle section of my book is all about how we can intentionally design processes and systems that support a workplace culture of innovation and bottom-up empowerment, but without losing sight of accountability. And I tried to strike that balance as I was writing that section of the book. But in good news, these are practices that any nonprofit can do with any size staff or any size budget. For example, how can your workplace culture help or hinder innovation? Or when it comes to decision-making, are you top-down or are you bottom-up? And why is that? What is specific language that supervisors can use to encourage team members to speak up and challenge the status quo? How do we walk the talk with our organizational principles like Mayo Clinic did in those stories? And so that section of the book then also shares like HR practices and recruiting and performance reviews. Might sound boring, but how our budget process can help or hinder innovation, it matters too, because you're actually doing a lot of hard trade-off thinking. So your budget process actually can really encourage strategic thinking. So yeah, that middle section of the book with stories like Mayo Clinic is really just all about organizational structures and processes, organizational design, and it's full of stories to illustrate how we can build innovation into our everyday workplace practices.
I really love how you tie in empowerment with innovation. Because I think the two go hand in hand.
I think so, absolutely. Yeah, I think the people on the ground, you know, doing the work, they're going to have the best knowledge. So there are important roles for executive leadership. You know, a lot of times they have kind of a big picture view of the whole organization, or they're tasked with risk. I rewrote it a lot. I was really struggling with that, the one chapter on like, you know, there are times for bottom-up empowerment, like I think Mayo Clinic stories illustrate that really well. But then are there also times where, you know, the executive director is the right person to make a call? And an example of that might be, let's say you have a major donor who is planning to give your organization maybe $2 or $3 million, and that donor just got caught up in a scandal. Now, what do you do? Like, should the intern make that decision? Probably not, right? There's kind of a set of criteria for how do you go about deciding who should make a decision in the organization. And the person being closest to the information is a factor. Risk is another factor. So the book tries to break that out. But doing that the wrong way, if we don't have clear thinking about who gets to make decisions and what, can definitely get in the way of innovation if we're not approaching it wisely.
And it sounds like in any nonprofit, your resources are typically very limited. And that can be very stressful. And so quite often that leads to people just trying to control, here's what we do and how we focus our attention.
Yes, yes. And I think limited resources don't have to be a reason why we can't be innovative. And it was really inspiring. I don't know, I'm a kind of a nerd when it comes to reading stories like this, but, you know, reading the origin stories of all nonprofits, even the ones we've heard of, started small and humbly, whether it's, you know, Mayo Clinic or Habitat for Humanity or the Civil Rights Movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Association, Alcoholics Anonymous, all have super interesting, inspiring startup stories where, you know, there's just maybe a founder or two or three with a passion for, we want to solve a problem. We're just not quite sure how we're going to do it. You know, very limited resources. And, you know, their stories are so interesting, how they found their theory of change eventually, kind of through trial and error and experimentation, and how they figured it out. So I'm a big believer that lack of resources is not a constraint to innovation at all.
How do people typically develop their theory of change?
I love that question. So theory of change, I would say, whether we want to admit it or not, every single nonprofit program is based on guesswork. You know, we don't always know what's going to work. Most of the time, we don't know what's going to work. So we can call that a theory of change. We might call it a bet or an experiment or a hypothesis. Some people will call it a logic model. So there's kind of variations on it.
What is a theory of change?
Yes. So it's kind of just a hypothesis for how you believe your efforts will have an impact. So you usually will see, and I write about this in the book, you'll see a logic chain or kind of an if-then sequence. So we might say if A, then B, then C, then we expect D to happen. And, you know, through this chain of logic, then we think we're going to have the ultimate impact that we want to see that will lead you to your desired destination. And so the reason we do this is it can be really helpful to ask, what are the conditions or sequential actions that need to be in place? So an example of that, or this is a very simple example. So there's a wildlife conservation organization in South Africa called Rhinos Without Borders. And so they might have a theory of change, and I'm going to use that if-then logic. So it might go something like, if we can move an endangered herd to a safer, more remote location or wilderness area, then the herd might be safe from poachers. So you heard that kind of if then. And it's a theory. You know, they don't know. It's a kind of an educated guess. And so they're going to design their programming around that hypothesis. So that's a very simple version. A little, and, you know, it's going to be different. You can have a theory of change at the organization level. You can have one at the program level. A different example might be Habitat for Humanity. So anyone who's worked with Habitat, a lot of people know about Habitat. You know, they're more than just shelter for people. Their model is not just to simply raise money and build high rises to get people a place to live. They're more, a little more complex than that. So if we were to just do a little guesswork, you know, this is not their official theory of change. This is just me speculating a little bit. But here, listen for the if-then language again. So it might be something like, if Habitat homeowners personally participate in building their house with their own hands and paying for their mortgage, and if obstacles are removed like unaffordable mortgages, then homeowners are personally transformed. They gain skills and pride of ownership. They gain credit history and build equity. They gain a sense of community and a more stable foundation to build a life on for their family. So notice how a theory of change takes a far-off vision. It might be 10 years or further into the future, and just provides a theory for how that vision could be achieved. And it makes our underlying thinking and assumptions explicit, which serves as a guide in making better informed decisions about on-the-ground strategy and daily activities. So I work with economists where I work. I'm at a nonprofit that's an economic research center, and I interviewed a number of them for my book. And one of them offered this really helpful insight about theory of change. He said, think about it in the same way that an architect relies on a small-scale model to see how the whole house comes together. And I thought that was brilliant. I'd never heard that before, but he didn't even work in the nonprofit space, but I just thought that was really insightful. And that is how we use the theory of change. Really, it's very helpful in that way. So then how do we build it if we're just starting from scratch? So I unpack that a lot in the book through the origin stories of nonprofits. But there's always, you know, this initial startup phase where they started very small, humble, and local. Usually, as I mentioned, there's a group of founders or a founder who just has a really strong sense of a social problem they want to solve, but they're deeply committed to doing something about it, but they just may not be sure yet what the nonprofit's going to look like or what programming should look like. And so they have to experiment and try to figure things out. But we're probably don't have the time to go into the full story. But the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous is so interesting. You know, they're just two alcoholics from different sides of the country who accidentally met and then had a really honest conversation about their struggles with addiction. And what they did was they discovered the power of one alcoholic talking to another very honestly. And it helped both of them find sobriety after they tried many, many things and were highly frustrated that nothing was working. But this conversation like did something for them. And so they realized, you know, the power in this, and they wanted to share it with others. But really, they had no idea how they were going to go about doing that. And it would take decades, you know, over time of kind of trial and error and experimentation until eventually they discovered their 12-step model. Eventually, they learned the hard way that it would be good if members should be anonymous. There's a story there. But in each of these kind of lessons or approaches, they would start with a hunch and then experiment and learn by doing. And so what our theory of change helps us say is, here's what we think will work, and now we're going to test it. And those design thinking exercises are really good at kind of helping draw out our thinking about what might work so that we can create a good theory of change.
Love that. Just this idea of trial and error is how you iterate an idea and make it better. So just saying, hey, Alcohol Anonymous didn't become what it is today right from the start. They actually had to experiment and try new things. And it sounds like the way that you use the theory of change is like to really make it clear, here's what the assumptions are that I want to test and get feedback on.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I've got a whole chapter on experimentation with stories of what that might look like. And I think some of these words can really throw people off. Like I've had this happen to me in nonprofit workshops, you know, where I might use the word strategy and that will mean something completely different to the person than what it means in my mind, or experiments. You know, I think sometimes we can talk past each other and experiment. Someone might think of like a science lab, or, you know, what does that mean? We're doing social services, or, well, I'm an economic research center. What do you mean by experimentation? And so I thought it was really important to have a lot of examples in my chapter on experimentation and just the range of different types of experiments we can have. I could share a really short story if we have time on what experimentation looks like. So World Reader is a nonprofit that has a mission to bring digital books to disadvantaged children and their families. And when they launched in 2010, they began several experiments at the same time. So in one experiment, they gave tablets, e-reader machines, to children in Ghana, and they were elementary students. But what they found was that when the children would play during recess, the devices kept breaking. And they didn't expect that. They were really excited about the tablet option. And so then at the same time, their team was experimenting with a mobile app. And it surprised them. But what they learned from observation was the mobile app ended up working much better. And the young users much preferred the mobile app over the e-reader tablet. So after that experimentation, they learned from that. And today, almost 200,000 users a month of children are reading books on the mobile platform, which is great. So I think there's a number of good lessons in that. They were really smart to spread their bets. And, you know, if World Reader would have gone all in on the tablet, they probably never would have discovered the far better solution with the mobile app. So to me, I think it's far better to fail fast and fail small before investing big. And experimentation is really what helps us learn and innovate. But part of that, too, is that we have to build in expectation and toleration of failure. And I think that's really important for board members, executive directors, for organizations to have that right attitude towards risk and failure. An example that I really love is from the Hewlett Foundation, where they offer a prize to grants officers and encourage them to share what they call the worst grant from which you learned the most. And they just have a sense of humor about it. I think they offer silly door prizes and they just gather together and can laugh and learn. And I think that takes the pressure off. And that's great, because that kind of culture of no fear, you know, really allows us to be honest. And, you know, where I work at the Mercatus Center, our board tells us that it's okay to fail as long as you're learning and growing. And they fully expect, like, if we show up at the board meeting with no stories of risk or failure, that we know that we would be in trouble. So that has to come from the top, though, right? And if it doesn't, then people are going to be timid. Of course they will be, right? So it's got to come from the top. So to me, it's really important with that design thinking, right, to first get your thinking clear and then try to design small experiments that can test that thinking. And then based on what we learn from experiments and from our failures, we can start to get clarity about what works. And our vision and strategy and theory of change are going to come into sharper focus.
I love that. And just that whole arc of how do you approach creating more innovation in your company. And then this last bit, really talking about the importance of failing, right? So if you're not experimenting and have a culture where it's okay to fail, you're going to play it safe. And you might not discover a much better solution that can create a better impact at a lower cost.
Exactly.
And it's interesting what you said too, that that has to come from the top, that, hey, this is okay and this is part of our culture, so that you have that empowerment, that freedom to kind of fail and make the decision and learn and then bring that back.
Exactly.
Fantastic. I feel like we've covered a lot in such a short period of time. It's really exciting that, you know, you're able to write this book and put this out. It seems for any nonprofit that's listening, that's struggling with, hey, how can I create more innovation and kind of deliver my impact more efficiently? Things that I heard were, one, you know, creating an environment where people are empowered, creating a place where people are running experiments, where they are asking questions in a design thinking way to really learn and get feedback that's going to help them make better decisions. And then creating that environment where kind of a structured approach to testing their assumptions through developing a theory of change, really being analytical about saying, hey, here's what we're trying to test and validate, and having the freedom to fail and try something new in order to get there.
Brilliant. You nailed it. Yeah, I think that summarizes the book perfectly. Thank you.
Fantastic. How do people find out about what you're doing and where do they find the book?
The book is available at all major retailers. And I have a website. It's just my name, leahkroll.com. And if you stop by my website, you know, I blog about this regularly. So you can sign up for my blog there. I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn and Twitter, just writing and thinking about these questions of nonprofit innovation. And there's a little bit of a community there, which is fun. We have a lot of discussions about these questions. So feel free to reach out to me that way. And on my website, there's now a free discussion guide for the book. So I think that's a great way to start. You can download this discussion guide. And then I'm just not a believer in boilerplate. You know, I'm a big believer in tailored solutions, that every nonprofit's unique. So, you know, you could download this discussion guide and then just zero in on whatever your nonprofit's particular needs are. If you know, want to take your team through one of the design thinking exercises, or if you're like, what I'm struggling with right now is metrics, you can go right to the metrics chapter. There's a chapter on the donor-grantee relationship and how that can help or hinder innovation. So the book is really meant to be tailored, you know, and use it how you need it. It's extremely practical. So those are all ways that you could find out more about the book.
I love that. Well, and you've been working with nonprofits for a couple of decades, so you have a lot of experience, but you also interviewed over 100 nonprofits for the book. So you really have a deep understanding of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I've been getting feedback from readers just that it's an extremely practical book and that it's very relatable, you know, and I was started research for the book, kind of doing a literature review and seeing what other books are out there. And I didn't see the book that I wanted to write. You know, there might be books that were more academic in nature or, you know, an entire book on metrics, but kind of being inspired by Edward Deming, I'm a systems thinker, you know, you think of the human body, right? The human body is kind of a whole and then there are pieces, right? Like an arm or a leg. And to me, those components of innovation all kind of fit together in one system, and each one are important, right? When you take workplace culture out of the mix, you're probably not going to have an innovative organization, right? Or if you botch how you do metrics, then you end up, you know, just creating bureaucratic obstacles for people. You're probably not going to have innovation, right? So I think it's important to look at all these things as a whole, and that's how I approach the book.
Fantastic. If you're listening, go check out leahkroll.com and we'll have more resources in the show notes for where to buy the book. I think there's so many nonprofits where they're struggling with innovation and staying current. So thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was an honor to be here. I really enjoyed our conversation.
That's great.